Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Try Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost, built for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, incredible load times, and 24/7 WordPress priority support, your sites will be lightning fast with global reach. And with Bluehost Cloud, your sites can handle surges in traffic no matter how big. Plus, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. Get started now at Bluehost.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Wednesday, June 5th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the first two episodes of the new Star Wars series, The Acolyte. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at SlashFilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And Star Wars expert and co-host of the Full of Sith podcast, Brian Young.
Just delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, Brian. Thank you so much for coming back. It's always a pleasure to talk about Star Wars with you. You know more about Star Wars than anybody else that I've ever met in my entire life. So, yes, really thrilled to be talking with you about this new series from creator Leslie Headland, who most people might know from her work on movies like Bachelorette, and she was one of the creative voices behind Russian Doll. We've been really looking forward to this series for a long time because it promised us something new, something separate from the Skywalker saga, and taking place at a different point on the timeline. So I'm sure we'll get into all of this as we go. But before we get into like spoiler stuff, I'm curious about like broad spoiler-free reactions to these first two episodes that are now up on Disney Plus. Brian, since you're the guest, what did you make of these first two episodes?
Like you can see in my review on Slash Film, I kind of got into a lot of detail about it, but it really felt like Leslie Headland provided prequel fans their version of The Force Awakens, where J.J. Abrams kind of showed all that love for the classic trilogy. Leslie Headland brought us something that feels very much in that prequel vein, which works for fans like me who like the prequels. I could see where it might be grating to some who don't, but I think it has an advantage in that it is 83 years removed from The Phantom Menace, or 87 years removed from The Phantom Menace, and is in this really interesting spot and on the timeline, and just gives us a really interesting murder mystery that feels straightforward in some ways, but that there's so many more layers obviously there waiting to be peeled back that it just invites the audience to wonder what's going on. And I really like that sort of storytelling.
Yeah, for sure. You mentioned that it feels a little bit like the prequels. I'm not a huge prequel fan, and I still came away from these first two episodes really enjoying what I saw. So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of like a test case for Kathleen Kennedy and the folks at Lucasfilm in terms of like the average Star Wars fan, I guess. Like, I'm not nearly as fanatical about it as either of you two. I haven't even seen any of the animated shows. So I'm going into this kind of as fresh as you can. You know, I knew going in that it was set during the time of the High Republic, but I didn't really know what that was. You know, I've read a couple explainers on Slash Film, but that's about the extent of my involvement in that. And I felt like it was really refreshing to be able to go into a show without having to feel like, okay, I have to watch six other things and read these books and know what's going on. I feel like it did a pretty good job of being able to just drop you right in and let you enjoy this murder mystery adventure. But Brad, what'd you make of it?
I'm kind of in the same boat because in a similar fashion, I feel like this is refreshing in the same way that the first season of The Mandalorian was when it arrived, because you didn't necessarily need any prior Star Wars knowledge to jump into it and enjoy the story. It felt firmly situated in a specific genre and just kind of starts with a narrative that you are introduced to new characters. There's nothing that's tied to like any key part of the Skywalker saga or anything from the movies. And it's venturing into mostly uncharted territory. So it provides a story that doesn't need any homework, you know, because one of the things that I feel like has maybe been frustrating for people who aren't, you know, big Star Wars fans, is that The Mandalorian eventually started to veer into Dave Filoni's Clone Wars sandbox and start digging into Ahsoka and all these different storylines that if you didn't keep up with the animated stuff, it's a little hard to latch onto. Whereas here, you know, even though we're dealing with an era that has been somewhat touched upon with the High Republic books, there's only one character from the books that, you know, pops up in this series, and you don't have to know anything about that character to understand what they're doing in this show. It's set up as the Jedi are basically detectives trying to figure out what's going on with these murders of Jedi. There's a compelling mystery at the center of it, and it's just it provokes a lot of curiosity. If there's one setback I have for the show is that so far I feel like I have a hard time being invested in the characters specifically, and for me it's the story that's the most interesting so far. And so I hope that we get a little bit something more to like latch onto when it comes to actually caring about the characters.
Mm, interesting. Okay. Well, I think that's probably as good as we need to do in terms of prelude and spoiler-free stuff. So let's get into full spoiler stuff. And I'm actually interested to drill down a little bit more on what you mean there, Brad. Like, is there a performance that stands out to you as being like maybe not up to your liking, or what is it about these characters that is not really pulling you in?
If I'm being honest, I don't think that many of the performances are what I would call great. I don't think anybody is terrible in it necessarily, but there's something about the tone that just feels a little, I don't know, ham-fisted or like 90s fantasy melodramatic to me. And that could be something that is echoing the style of the prequels, which does have that issue as well. But I do, I feel like, yeah, I don't know. There's just something about it that the performances just feel a little too heightened for what they're trying to do. And it makes it hard to actually really get into them as characters. The only one I think who actually works in the series super well is Lee Jung-jae. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Is that correct?
Maybe. Yes.
He plays Jedi Master Sol, and he's the one who like has an attachment to the main character, Osha, and her twin sister Mei. And so that's something that I think that his place in it and his dynamic with those characters works. But yeah, otherwise there's something about the drama in it that doesn't feel entirely authentic to me.
Brian, I'm wondering if you felt what Brad was talking about there. Even if you don't agree with it, do you understand what he's talking about?
I understand what Brad is talking about, and as he was describing it, he was like, it's like 90s fantasy melodrama, and I'm like, it's Phantom Menace. Yeah. But, you know, I do agree. I think Master Sol is hands down the strongest character on the show, and he's sort of the beating heart of it. But, you know, I wonder if it short sells Yord and Jeki and that dynamic, because those characters are really fun and kind of showing us a different window into the Jedi. Yord, I really dislike his character, which is why I like him so much, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
He just kind of sucks in the best ways.
He reminds me of how people kind of bag on like Leonardo from the Ninja Turtles, or like Cyclops from the X-Men or something like that, right?
Yeah, but Yord feels like way more of a douche than Leonardo does. There's I hope that it's a good performance and it's not just me disliking the guy who's playing him, because there's something about him that I really just don't like. I do appreciate Daphne Keene though as Jeki. I do think she's doing a good job in that role. That's another character that I enjoyed.
Especially as she keeps undercutting Yord.
Yeah.
Which I think that's part of that dynamic. So that kind of stuff really, really worked for me. As far as Amandla Stenberg and her performances, Mei and Osha, it feels very Star Wars, if that makes sense. Especially like that opening scene. It feels like a mix between Star Wars and sort of those, you know, Kung Fu style movies, right? Mm-hmm. That opening scene with Master Andara, played by Carrie Ann Moss, and Mei as, you know, the Sith assassin coming after her. It was a kung fu fight in a kung fu movie that happened to be dressed up as Star Wars. And so that cheesiness, like, I felt like it set the tone to set the expectation of what the acting and the character work was going to be like going in for me. So I wasn't expecting, you know, Luthen Rail's quality of monologue from Andor coming into this show with that introduction, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like it had set my expectations for what it could be.
I think that's fair, but I think maybe my biggest problem with Amandla's performance is that it doesn't really feel like she's doing much to differentiate the traits between Osha and Mei. Like, obviously they're twins, but they're also like different people. And so I'm not seeing a clear like delineation between what she's doing with either of the performances.
As I've watched these first two episodes a few times now, I think that in these first two episodes, that's really Leslie Headland's direction, because if you're a first-time viewer watching this unfold, I think you're supposed to be confused about the two characters and who they are. And as the episodes, as we get further into episode two, they start to delineate more. But in the first, part of the mystery is like, is she innocent or guilty until they solve that? And you know what I mean? So part of that, they seem like they're doing the same thing, feels like it was a directorial choice, because they do differentiate each other later in the story.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah, I kind of felt that too, because I didn't even know that she was a twin. I mean, I think that's a big part of the marketing of the show, but I've not really engaged with anything about the Acolyte in the lead up. I just kind of jumped into the series effectively blind. So yeah, that played as a reveal for me. And I wonder if that might, for some, you know, non-diehard Star Wars fans who just decide to drop into the show or whatever. But Brian, you mentioned that opening fight. And like, I personally have not been that excited by a Star Wars fight scene since the throne room battle in The Last Jedi. I loved that moment. What did you make of the martial arts infused opening scene there, Brad?
Yeah, it's, if there's one thing that I really dig about the show so far, more than anything else, it's that the fight sequences are, they bring something new to the table. You know, there's a wuxia element to it that we haven't seen much in live action Star Wars. And it's nice to see, you know, characters who are able to hold their own against, you know, Jedi wielding the Force and lightsabers, without necessarily needing to engage in lightsaber combat at the end of the day. So that's a cool element to see play out in a show like this.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and May, like, I just like the character designs in the show too. Like May, the costume design specifically, she just looks cool as hell with the purple robes and the mask and everything. It's just like a really striking, a striking presentation of that character. I wrote down Pip Rules, this little side creature that she's got there. Brian,
isn't it great when Star Wars introduces a cool new little guy for us to love?
It really is, yeah. Brian, where does Pip rank in your personal pantheon of cool little guys for us to love?
Oh, man, the hard thing about Star Wars is that somehow, every time you're like, they must have run out of ideas for cool little droids, they bring out a new one with each new project, whether that was, you know, we kind of thought that with BB-8 and then Chopper and then, well, Chopper first and then BB-8. And then all of a sudden we're like, well, how could they top that? And then it's BD-1. And then we've got BMO from Andor. And now we've got Pip. And it's just like, I don't know if they've got something in the water of all the designers where they're just like trying to top each other with cute droid designs. But this was really, Pip was just really cool. I think I might like him better than Dio, but my 8-year-old might murder me for that since Dio is their favorite. But it was just a really cool flourish to, like, where you see where droids would come. I mean, as far as utility, they actually sat down and thought about the design in the context of the universe and the period. And if you've got humans going out on decks of ships to fix things where you'd normally send astromechs, but humans are somehow cheaper, of course you'd give them a little droid like this that would probably be cheaper to manufacture, and they could do all of the things that an astromech could. And so it has those story design elements to it that I really like. I really love when the designers of Star Wars tell story with, you know, their character designs. And, mm-hmm. and I think Pip does that really, really well.
Yeah. The whole idea of the sort of astromech, I forget what the designation of her job is that she says, like, I'm a
mechanic.
Yeah. Something like that. But it's, was it a mechnic? Was it? It was, yeah, something, I think it was like, it was something kind like of like that, mechanic, yeah. But yeah, some sort of weird version of that. But yeah, like that's a thing. That's a trope that we've seen in, you know, a ton of other sci-fi properties, but I've never seen it in a Star Wars project before. So I just like how every time she says what her job is, all these different characters are always like, oh, that's dangerous. Like everybody knows in this world, like she's walking on the edge a little bit by OSHA is walking on the edge a little bit by participating in that job. But yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else, I guess, from this first episode that really jumped out at you guys that you wanted to mention here before we move into episode two?
Yeah, no, I mean, some of the other droids in the show, too, like not just Pip, but like that old fashioned gonk droid or the droids on the ship that sort of are piloting it. But as soon as they shut them down, they just turn into chairs.
Yeah, that was great.
Little design flourishes like that were really cool. And, you know, it's interesting to note that the planet that she crash lands on has some Star Wars history too. But I mean, it obviously appears in episode two as well. But the other thing is there are, I mean, for as much as it seems as though this episode feels like a really great introduction to folks that just want to watch a murder mystery in the Star Wars universe and not need to do all the homework other than just like being familiar with the universe, it does have an amazing amount of ties and consistency with other things in Star Wars, both forward with stuff we know from live action and cartoons and stuff, but also backwards with the entire High Republic era of books and comic books.
Yeah, I have not really dug into that, but it seems like one of those story choices that Leslie Headland and her writers made where it's additive instead of a requirement, right? Like that stuff sort of buoys your enjoyment instead of makes you feel like you're missing out, which is always the balance that I would prefer storytellers to strike if possible. But there was one thing that I wanted to ask you about, Brian. There's a moment where Master Soul says that he saw May die in her childhood. And without getting into spoilers, I think Disney has given out the first four episodes. I'm not sure if you've watched ahead, but I have not. I've just watched the first two episodes. So without getting into any spoilers of what happens beyond these first two episodes, are we looking at some sort of like Sith bringing people back to life stuff here with what happened with May? Like just, I don't know if you can speculate without giving anything away if that question has been answered.
I have watched the episodes, but what I think is going on and what I thought was going on before I watched the episodes, especially with the way episode two unfolds, where May thought OSHA had died and OSHA had thought May died, and this was something that they both thought. I actually think it goes back a little bit to the themes of Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi and the idea that reality is skewed by our own point of view. And so what we're seeing is sort of that Rashomon effect where everybody experienced something different and came away with a different understanding of it. And I think that holds true for Master Saul. I think that holds true for Master Torben, who we get introduced to in episode two. And I think it definitely holds true to May and OSHA. And even through the next two episodes, I don't want to say anything about, it seems like there's going to be a lot of layers about that situation that we'll need to peel back to really understand exactly what happened from as objective a point of view as we can.
Mm-hmm. Brad, there's a moment as this episode comes to a close where May seems to meet with her, presumably her Sith master, who is still a very mysterious figure as through the second episode, and talking about like the power of killing a dream and how an acolyte could do that and sort of help maybe potentially bring down the Jedi, you know, from their place of dominance in the culture. I thought that was really interesting, and I was curious about your take on that. And then also like the look of that character, the master character that we see off in the distance, sort of in silhouette, it almost looks like he's wearing like a Kylo Ren-esque helmet. So I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that sort of mysterious villain character lurking in the shadows.
Yeah, I like the concept of the mystery of the villain, not knowing who it is. You know, there's obviously a trend in Star Wars villains where they are masked and you don't know who they are, and sometimes when they take off their helmet, that can be a surprise and, you know, change the game. This one is definitely a curious one, and it's a mystery that lingers for a while, even through the first four episodes. So, I like the style, and I do like the idea that this is something that like is meant to kind of like shake what the Jedi have come to stand for. You know, where they're at and what they're doing. That like, you know, talking about that. Of killing that dream, you know, it feels like it hints at something that could like have big ramifications for, you know, what we eventually will come to see in Phantom Menace and stuff like that, because the Jedi end up essentially being hoisted by their own petard and becoming victims of their own hubris. Mm-hmm. And being, you know, blinded because the dark side clouds everything, you know, and their arrogance does too. So I think that like that's an interesting hint there. And the first episode, as well as the second episode too, begins this kind of like trend that you will see where the episodes very intentionally end on somewhat of a kind of like a cliffhanger moment in a way, something that really entices you to want to watch the next episode, which is not something that happens super often with shows like this. You know, there's usually something that is like an interesting tease, but these feel like they really like hit home, like oh no, you're like they stop like in the middle of a big moment and like, yeah, you need to watch the next episode.
Yeah, I just thought this was a really good episode of television, a really enjoyable experience, and I was very pleasantly surprised by what we got here and by the promise that the show holds. So let's take a break and then we'll come back and talk about episode two.
Save big money at Menards. We're your destination for concrete landscaping blocks. We have the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Get free estimates fast using our easy do-it-yourself landscape design program in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on landscape products at Menards, America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. Visit JDPower.com for details and Menards.com for deals. Save big money at Menards.
All right, Brian. So what did you think about the second episode? Like, especially the idea of May trying to attack this Jedi character who is like meditating and he has this this essentially like force field around him. I haven't seen that happen in Star Wars before. You are like tapped into every single nook and cranny of Star Wars. So have you ever seen that represented in any sort of Star Wars media?
Yeah. What Master Torben has taken, and they reference it in the show, is called the Barash Vow. And that's something that originated with a character named Barash Sylvain, you know, a couple of hundred years before this point in the timeline. And basically, the Barash Vow is basically Jedi seeking penance, and they remove themselves from all aspects of life except for a communion with the Force. The first time we actually saw it in Star Wars, though, was actually in Charles Soule's Darth Vader comic, the volume 2 of the Marvel Comics there, and he is sort of, it's very much moments after Revenge of the Sith, and he's tasked with retrieving a new lightsaber for himself, and he goes into the Jedi archives and that he can piece together and finds a Jedi who has taken the Barash Vow long before Anakin Skywalker even entered the temple, and Vader hunts down this Jedi and takes down his lightsaber, but when he first encounters him, it is still very much the same view of the Jedi meditating in midair, trying to force out the real world and only commune with the Force. And it's this really cool idea. Of course, you'd have this monkish order have ways to commune with the Force to repent for things they feel like they've done wrong or remove themselves in the same way you might see in sort of like other Eastern philosophies. And that's really where it comes from. And it was really cool to see. And as we learn more about Master Torben in this episode, we see that he definitely has something he feels guilty about. Listening to them talk about the timelines and that May and Osha's tragedy happened 16 years prior, and it was just over 10 years that Master Torben had stopped speaking to anyone and taken that Barash Vow. Mm-hmm. It seems like the guilt of what happened there hung over his head for quite a while before he decided he couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, there's that moment where he says to, I think it's to May, he says, "Forgive me, we thought we were doing the right thing." And then he drinks that poison knowingly, which, like, obviously whatever they did must have been pretty bad for him to do that. So I like that, the mystery of them just sort of like slowly teasing out that, hey, these are the Jedi. These are the people that, you know, you, Ben Pearson, the very disconnected Star Wars fan, think are the good guys. And we may be interested in subverting those expectations and like showing that the Jedi are not maybe all they're cracked up to be in this show. So I certainly appreciate that. Brad, was there a moment from episode 2 that stuck out to you? Anything that that you really connected with?
No, so this moment with Torben is one that I think is a great driving force for the what's to come in the show, is because planting that seed of like, wow, what did they do that, like, this Jedi is just willing to be like, he's like, yep, I need to kill myself because there's no other way that I'm going to be able to repent for what happened. So like, yeah, some bad shit definitely went down. I'm curious about seeing how that unfolds as the series continues. I do want to point out just one little nitpick, because it just kind of bugged me. And I hated the hairpiece that they put on Torben, because it was very clearly a younger actor that they put like a balding headpiece on, and it just it made it look like when they tried to age Daniel Radcliffe for the end of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, where it's like, that just looks weird. like I didn't really need to see, you know, like a balding Jedi in that way. It just felt like a weird choice. You know, just give him some cool gray hair. Don't make him look like, you know, a dad who's, you know, working as an accountant somewhere. but yeah, no, I do think like that moment is particularly interesting.
I'm kind of mixed on the Khmer character. I think that's how you pronounce his name, played by Manny Jacinto. I loved him in The Good Place. And like on paper, this is the type of character that I'm really interested in, this sort of smuggler character who is like, you know, walking the edge of illegality and like dipping into some bad things. But he seems like maybe he has a heart of gold. And I like Manny Jacinto as a performer. I just wonder if like, maybe at least in episode 2 where we see him, if he just like doesn't necessarily have the script to work with that really helps flesh him out enough. I don't know. I was wondering if I was the only one that felt a little underwhelmed by that guy.
I kind of felt like that was by design. I have this sneaking suspicion that his character has a lot more to him and that this might be an act that his character is putting on.
I would love that. I hope that's true. What do you think the act might be?
I've got this like ridiculous idea in my head, the way he talks about the master, the way he talks about like the way he so capably puts the poison together, the way he reacts to everything and sort of manipulates something. I wouldn't be surprised if he was I wouldn't be surprised if he wasn't just a Sith apprentice, like it sort of implies, but that maybe he's the guy in the helmet.
Oh yeah, that would be really cool. Like a Ra's al Ghul in Batman Begins kind of thing, where there's
like Sidious and Palpatine, right? And the one thing we know about the Sith is that their apprentices are always looking for their own apprentices in order to build the power to kill their master.
Mm.
And so maybe that's what's going on here. I have no idea. But that's just sort of the ridiculous idea that I had pop into my head as I was watching him, because I think you're right. Like, it feels like it's too pat. And I don't think Leslie Headland works like that. I think there's going to be layers to peel back. And that's the only layer I could see for him that makes sense from a story perspective. Although Leslie Headland could surprise me and come up with different layers to show me. And I won't be disappointed by that.
Sure.
But I think that would be really interesting to see from him.
Yeah, absolutely. Once again, we get a really great fight scene with Sol versus May out in the sort of courtyard area with what is his name? Yord looking down through the binoculars and everything. That was a really cool hand-to-hand sort of melee type of situation again. Brad, was there anything else that you wanted to point out about episode 2?
So I have one issue with this fight too, because while I do like the choreography and how Sol and May are fighting each other, I was a little disappointed in kind of the set piece overall, because like it feels strange that they're just having this fight in an open space rather than having it in an area where they can like use things to their advantage, you know, whether it's the environment or items around and stuff like that. And maybe that's just me, I don't know, appreciating a little bit more about like what movies like John Wick and stuff like that have done recently. And obviously wuxia action is much different than what we get in John Wick, but even so, I just like it felt almost like a failure on like the set design part of like not doing something that felt like a little more compelling, because like that fight could have literally happened anywhere. There was nothing important about where it was happening that did anything to affect that scene, you know.
Could I offer a counterpoint to that? Because I think it did some really interesting storytelling in that set piece where you notice they had the dirt ground, right? And you can see how disturbed the dirt gets based on the mastery of the force of each of the characters. So that when Master Sol is using the force, he's not disturbing that dirt at all. When Yord comes down and he's using the force, dirt is flying everywhere. And May, the most out of control, is the one who spreads that dirt into everyone's face and just sort of blows it up. And that really felt like the important piece of the set, that it was telling that story about their different levels of the force and their abilities and their mindsets with the set in that way. So it was interacting with the set, just not in the ways we'd normally expect.
Well, see, and there's Brian coming in with something that I did not, you know, pick up on or observe. So like, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I agree. That's a great read, and a really wonderful bit of like super subtle storytelling there. But yeah, I kind of am with you a little bit, Brad. Like, I feel like maybe they could have done it in a way, in an area that didn't feel so much like the Indiana Jones stunt spectacular kind of thing. You know,
it's
like
exactly. A little
hermetically sealed, kind of like you didn't really feel like the characters were like the I guess, like, for lack of a better term, like NPC characters were like wandering around. It was just like very empty and very soundstagey or whatever. But I'm trying to think if there's anything else I wanted to talk to you guys about before we wrap things up here. Oh, Brad, you mentioned like the endings of these episodes have this sort of cliffhanger aspect. I loved the ending of the first episode. I was very underwhelmed by the ending of the second episode where we meet Kelnaka, the Wookiee character, this Jedi who's on this hit list, and he scares off a couple of, scares off a couple of scavengers. I just thought it was kind of like, oh, that's the end, huh? Like, it was just kind of like ended in the middle of a scene. So I was a little underwhelmed by the ending of the second episode. But did you have like a different feeling going out of that episode than I did?
No, I mean, not necessarily a different feeling, but I think I appreciate what Leslie's doing there, because this is, we haven't ever seen a Wookiee Jedi in Star Wars like this before. And we know that there's one in the High Republic books and stuff like that. But if you're a more casual Star Wars fan, you've never seen a Wookiee Jedi before. So I think just the introduction of a character like that is something cool to see, and like setting that up for something that's going to happen, you know, in a later episode, you know that's there. And so for me, I didn't mind that it was something that kind of felt sudden, and it wasn't necessarily something that like raised a big mystery or something like that, but it was just something new that we haven't seen and set something up for the future.
I would say 2 points on that. The first one, really quickly, we also had Gunji, who was the Wookiee Jedi Padawan in Clone Wars, who also appeared in the Bad Batch. So we have had some Wookiee lightsaber combat and stuff on the screen. But Kelnaka, I think to your point, most people haven't watched that, but Kelnaka is really cool there. But I kind of felt like for us to understand the mystery and the four Jedi that she's after, it felt to me an appropriate story introduction, because we've spent so much time with the other three Jedi. Mm-hmm. Seeing who that next Corey is going to be and where the next episode would likely play out because of May's hunt, felt like it was teasing what we were going to see. And Kelnaka sort of very easily dispatching those people and living out in the middle of nowhere, and coupled with her concerns that she wouldn't be able to find him, made it seem very pertinent story-wise to me. But yeah. I can understand where, you know, it's not as exciting as a Sith with a red lightsaber.
Yeah.
To clarify, I didn't like, I mean like live action Wookiee Jedi.
Oh yeah. I know.
That's the biggest thing.
Well, and his design is really cool. I love how they've got like the shaved head and top knot thing that goes back to that Kurosawa vibe. There's a lot about Kelnaka we haven't seen before in live action in Star Wars, and I really dig it, right? I mean, really, the only other two Wookiees we've had meaningfully were Tarful and Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Not counting the holiday special.
Yes, of course. Okay, so I just wrote down two other things real quick that I wanted to mention. There's a moment where Osha hits on Jeki, I thought, like the Saul's Padawan character, where she's talking about being flexible, and I was like, oh man, they might be like, laying some groundwork for a potential relationship or sort of interesting dynamic between these two characters. So I just wanted to clock that in case we ever come back and talk about the show in more detail later on. Brian, I wanted to ask you about the moment when Saul kind of runs into the bureaucracy of the Jedi. And I think it's Vernestra, senior member of the Jedi Order, who is effectively his boss, played by Rebecca Henderson in the show. She pops up on this hologram or whatever, and basically tells him to like stop his investigation because the Jedi have to like talk about it and discuss and strategize and stuff like that. I was just wondering what you made of that scene and sort of how he feels sort of, flustered or blocked by the bureaucracy of the organization that he's part of.
Yeah. You know, if you look at really one of the core themes of Star Wars is that, or at least the prequels, is that evil can use bureaucracy as a tool. And evil can flourish under the guises of that bureaucracy and still seem benign, right? Like, and still see like, well, we're just trying to come to the best solution. And that's really a lot of how Palpatine sort of takes power and grinds the gears down on the Jedi. And I think Vernestra is one of those characters that for those who have been following the High Republic was sort of the antithesis of that. When she was younger, she was one of the youngest Jedi ever to be knighted. She was knighted at 17. And part of that was her ability to sort of jump into the action, especially in the war against the Nile, and to see that change over the last 100 years since we've seen her on the timeline. It's a really marked difference in that it makes you feel like the wars that the Jedi went through 100 years prior against the Nile and the Drenger really gave them some trauma to cope with as an institution, not just individually. And I think Saul is bumping against that in really interesting ways. And I think the audience does too. And so Leslie Headland has talked in interviews about how this really sort of kicks off the beginning of the end of the Jedi that we see in the prequels. And I think that moment specifically with Vernestra and that bureaucracy is exactly that line between the two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's well said. Speaking of things being well said, you said in your review, which is up on slashfilm.com right now, that this part of the timeline of Star Wars is exciting, but it feels familiar enough to be comfortable. And that's kind of how I feel about this show overall. There's like this familiar imagery, but it feels like a different flavor of Star Wars than what I've seen before. And it's very different than Andor, which is my personal favorite Star Wars show. So I'm pretty impressed overall with what I've seen. And I mean, there were a couple little missteps here and there, I thought, but for the most part, I'm on board with what Leslie Headland's doing here. So any closing thoughts, Brad, before we wrap it up?
No, I don't think so. You know, I think it's a cool, promising new direction for Star Wars TV right now. And I'm just interested in seeing where it all ends up.
Okay, excellent. Brian, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
So you can always go to /film, and a lot of the new coverage on the shows is me. But even if it's not me, there's a ton of great writers working on Star Wars at Slash Film. You can listen to my Star Wars podcast every week at fullofsith.com. And you can find me personally on the internet across social media at Swankmotron or at swankmotron.com.
Excellent. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Brian. I'm not sure what our plan is going to be for other podcast coverage of The Acolyte as we move through the season. Fingers crossed, maybe we can get back together and do this one more time, maybe at the end of the season or something like that, just to sort of wrap it all up and talk about the stuff that's happened in between. But if we don't, then it was a pleasure speaking with you as always, and hopefully we'll see you again soon. I think in the meantime, you can definitely check out Brian's review, which I'm going to link to in the show notes of this episode. I'm going to link to a bunch of our other coverage as well. And as everyone has said, go to slashfilm.com for a bunch more stuff there. Slashfilm Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really does help us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.